Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. And this is a podcast for anyone who wants to discover how to succeed with testing and automation, as well as what works for testing any software development project. Today, we'll be speaking with Dima Kovalenko about Selenium best practices. But first, this week was Thanksgiving in the US, and one thing I'm really thankful for is our sponsor, Sauce Labs. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. As Dima says, nothing is more soul-crushing than having a test suite that is all over the place and just fails randomly. If you have ever felt this way, I've got the cure for all your test automation flakiness blues. In this episode, Dima Kovalenko, author of Selenium Design Patterns and Best Practices, shares with us the best strategies to creating reusable, maintainable, stress-free Selenium tests. This was an awesome interview that I had with Dima. We talked for over an hour, and it took me a while to edit it down into the standard 30-40 minute format we usually have. I hope to get him back on the show to talk in depth about continuous integration and best practices using Selenium against a CI environment. So get ready to absorb a bunch of automation awesomeness. Check it out. Hey, Dima. Welcome to Test Talks.
Hello. Nice to be here.
It's great to finally have you on the show. And today I'd like to talk about your awesome new book, Selenium Design Patterns and Best Practices. But before we do, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
I started working in software development and software testing back in 2003 for a small back then company called Rosetta Stone. And basically, I had no formal education whatsoever, no classes in college or anything like that. Everything I've learned about software testing and development has been slowly acquired over time through self-education and just having really good coworkers who would spend the time and teach me. And that's basically how I started. Ended up currently working at Groupon, and part of the reason that I'm enjoying working here is that they're allowing me to spend some time actually to work with Selenium and contribute back to the project itself. So the problems that I find, which are making it difficult for me to accomplish something, can be fixed in the code itself instead of just making a blog post. So that makes me very happy. I've been going to several Selenium conferences. I really enjoy going to those and meeting new people. I'll be honest, first couple of times was completely scary, but as you meet more and more people who are kind of excited about the project and about testing in general, it's kind of fun to find like-minded people. So to me, it's a huge treat. It's something I look forward to every year, is to go and hang out with the people you see online and who write blogs and once in a while chat on Skype or something.
So why did you feel a need to write the Selenium Design Patterns and Best Practices book?
One of them was actually just a bucket list thing to do. I always wanted to write a book. I didn't know what it was about. I was kicking around the idea ever since basically 2003, when I first started, as to what I'm learning. And as I am kind of picked up and solved problems that in manual testing, I always had like monologue in the background going, okay, if this should be a chapter about testing on the databases, and this should be a chapter on testing this stuff, and just putting down onto paper what I've learned kind of helped me also to arrange some of the ideas that I was thinking about by putting them on paper. So to me, it was a twofold thing. I really wanted to share, but at the same time, I wanted to crystallize some of the ideas that I've been kicking around. That way they can be kind of appreciated by me, where it's like, oh yeah, that's why I always believe in this. And this is why I always do it in this way. And it's not just making up things as I go.
Awesome. Yeah, I agree. For some reason, just writing helps sometimes to clarify what we believe. I really enjoy this book. I love the flow of it. And starting with the first chapter when you say, you know, today's your first day on the job. So you really ease in, you know, you really go chapter by chapter and build up on a foundation that I think is going to be really, really a great resource for like someone that's starting new with testing in Selenium.
Absolutely. And that was my intention. Personally, my style of learning tends to be hands-on. That's the best way. I can go to class and read all the textbooks for days and days at a time, but honestly, I don't really learn anything from it. But for me personally, just having a hands-on real-world experience carry you through, and as you learn something, you know, the challenge becomes more and more complicated. That is basically how I learn, and I figured if I can put that down on paper, maybe somebody else who learns the same way that I do can take advantage of it.
Awesome. Yeah, I was reading some of the book reviews, and one person, they rated the book very highly, but they were disappointed that it was not in Java. But it really doesn't matter, because the principles you're teaching here apply to anything. You're just using Ruby as a way to teach people these principles, but you could still apply it. I use Java, C#, same thing applies. So why did you choose Ruby out of all the language bindings to use?
My correction is that there are Java examples on the website that is used for the testing under the code section. I did provide a link to a GitHub account where there's examples both in Ruby and Java. And I'm hoping as I learn new languages, maybe C# or Python, to also translate those examples into a given language. Or if somebody requests a new language, such as Node or some other new language, I would like to actually translate the same examples into that language, but put it in such a way where it is easy to follow with the book. But now, instead of looking at Ruby example, you're looking at Java example. But part of the biggest reason I did use Ruby instead of Java is because I just finished learning Java and I'm still not that good. Ruby is a lot more comfortable to me. And on top of that, I honestly believe that Java might not be the best first learning language for people, since majority of the people who are starting off with the automation tests are not necessarily developers to begin with. They are manual QA people like myself. To just jump into Java is actually quite a hectic hurdle to get over. So Ruby reads more like pseudocode to me, and to a lot of people I know, and after talking to them about it, they seem to agree that maybe Ruby would be a little bit easier to read and follow through, and then have a similar example on the side in the language of choice.
Yeah, I definitely agree. If I had my choice, I would definitely use Ruby or Python, but for some reason, the companies I work for usually want you to use the same language that their developers use, and the developers end up not doing automation anyway, so it always confuses me.
I guess the other part of it, though, is that the ideas and how you approach solving a problem does not really matter which language you do it in, because one of the great things about Selenium is that the APIs are pretty robust and similar, that pretty much every binding you choose will have similar click commands, similar type commands. How you find elements on the page is quite identical between all the different languages. So it doesn't really matter what language you're reading with, as long as you figure out that, hey, this is how you find an element on the page. You can easily translate it into any other programming language.
Do you have an example where you actually show the syntax in all the different languages of a click? Yep, cool, I found it. It's under comparing Selenium commands in multiple languages. So you actually show side by side the language followed by the command to show how similar they actually are. It's pretty cool.
Yes, and that's what draws me in to the whole idea of Selenium, is that I can go and switch and get a job working for a .NET shop and still be able to get up to speed and write Selenium relatively fast without having to learn a lot of .NET first.
You know, that's such a great point. One of the main questions I always get asked is, I'm trying to learn Selenium, what language should I use? And I'm like, pick any language you're comfortable with and go with it, because What you're going to learn will apply to all the other language bindings and in general, all the automation principles. So just go for it and start learning whatever you're comfortable with now.
Absolutely. It's very similar to a question that I hear a lot is what continuous integration system to use. Well, it doesn't really matter. Just pick one. If you don't want to pick one, then just write a simple shell script that runs every 2 hours. That's still better than nothing. And then you can kind of go any way you want afterwards.
Yeah, I think maybe because people are engineers, they might overanalyze, but not actually get to the doing. So I definitely agree. Just pick something and go with it. And you could always change later, but what you're learning and what you're putting in place can only help you rather than hurt you, I think.
Absolutely. And just ideas, I guess. Our problem is that we tend to get bogged down too much in the details of the implementation and miss the forest for the tree. Being an English second language, all the idioms kind of go sideways for me.
So bringing up nationalities, of course, mm-hmm. being Italian, the first pattern that caught my eye is the spaghetti ante pattern. What is a spaghetti ante pattern?
I think we should first talk what is an ante pattern, which is basically the short answer to it is something that makes sense and seems like a good idea at the time, but turns out to be a horrible, horrible idea later down the road. So that's an anti-pattern. Spaghetti code anti-pattern, it's a very common anti-pattern used in software development where the code itself is kind of spread out and tied to each other in very weird and unexpected ways, where some test may be using some method calls inside of another test that is unrelated to the first one, and you have a strand of dependency that is looping all through your test suite. And then if you step back and look at the whole test suite, all you see is these dependency strands that go all over the place, and it is very difficult to make any sense of it because there's no logical division into, hey, this is for the registration page, and this is for the purchase page, and this is for... There's no separation like that. It's just all over the place. A very, very common example of spaghetti code would be when people first start to learn to use Selenium, you go into the Selenium IDE and you record a couple of test runs. You record a walk through the purchase flow and then you walk through the registration flow. And between those two, there's a lot of similar code, and some of the code may be unrelated, but it's just a single line going together. Those two recorded tests are put next to each other. There's a lot of duplication between the two of them. But since they are separate tests and there's no logical framework, you do not see that duplication and you do not see the interdependencies right away. You just see one long strand of actions.
So it makes it hard to debug, basically, right? So if you had a dependency in a script and you don't know about it, something's hard-coded and you run it against a different environment, most likely it's not going to run and it's going to be hard to maintain.
Absolutely. It's hard to debug. It's hard to maintain. Recording and playing back a test is a very, very quick way to get started. But when you have a bunch of tests that are just strings of individual actions, what ends up happening is that every single time something changes on the website, all of the tests that are affected by that change are broken. So instead of having a registration action in one single place, it is spread all over the test suite. And now you have 10 or 20 tests that are breaking for no apparent reason. And now you have to go and fix those 20 breakages.
If someone is using the Selenium IDE or they're starting off brand new, would you recommend that they don't use Selenium IDE and just go in and start using the language bindings directly?
I always compared Selenium IDE to kind of bait and switch approach to Selenium testing, where you lure the person in with a pretty toy that you can easily click around on, but it is quite a weak tool because of the fact that it's running inside of the browser and it's running in JavaScript and HTML. It has a lot of weaknesses that are carried over from Selenium 1, the code base that was before WebDriver. So if you're new to Selenium, it's a great way for you to record a quick test, to show to your boss, hey, look, we can run a test very quickly and show some examples to the manager and kind of convince him and push him into the direction of increasing the automated test suite size. But if you plan to keep using it for the rest of your career, you're going to hit a dead end really quickly because of inherent limitations that are built into the Selenium IDE. So it's good to try and then switch over to something more robust, such as Java or Ruby.
Awesome. Yeah, I definitely agree. Did you have any tips on how to refactor Selenium test code?
Matter of fact, after I finished writing the book, I realized that the whole book is just nothing but refactoring. Every single chapter begins with refactoring of the previous chapter. So to start talking about refactoring of the code, one of the biggest books that influenced me was Design Patterns, Elements of Reusable Object-Oriented Software by Eric Gamma. And that book talked about just looking back at any piece of software and breaking it out into smaller and smaller parts, and then building up the software like a Lego house. In a similar way, when we're starting to refactor a spaghetti pattern, we can take out and basically start off by removing all the duplicate functionality and grouping it into a single place. If you have a couple of tests that use a method to fill out the registration form, well, let's move that out into a single method and have each of the tests call the method instead of having instance of that code themselves. Similarly speaking, once that is completed and once you've removed all the duplication, we can move on to improving the stability of the tests by grouping all of the methods that we pulled out into more sectioned situations. Thus, you can go for page object pattern where every single page is represented as a test code and it's mimicked in the test, and then individual parts of the page are stored in a single place as little modules that test kind of builds together as a little Lego house, and you have a whole page out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, just so people know, that you have a whole chapter dedicated to refactoring tests in your book, chapter 3, that goes over all the different principles and the different patterns, and it's really helpful. So we have our test, we refactored our test. Now we have a bunch of tests. How do we manage that so it doesn't grow into this monster test suite of thousands of tests? How do we know what to test? How to prune our test suite? How do we keep a manageable test suite, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Eventually, no matter how controlled you grow your test suite, it will become a monster test suite. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. More tests is always better than less tests, unless those tests are flaky and unreliable. But more good tests is always better than fewer good tests. But my approach in the past has been to try and cover everything in regression by adding a new test for every single regression action. However, my views have changed a little bit because that does turn into unmanageable situation where instead of testing new code, you're spending all of your time writing tests for code that has not been touched in years. So my approach nowadays is to grow with the new features. So as the new feature is being added, to write a test that follows that feature. And each new feature makes the previous test that you just wrote, turns it into a regression automatically. So your regression suite automatically grows. My favorite approach, of course, is to attack the money path. That is, any way the customer can give money to your company. You should have enough tests to prove that at no point the customer is not able to give you money. They will be able to forgive you if the upload picture button is broken, or if the colors are wrong, or if something doesn't look good. But if they are not able to purchase the product that they want, your customers will get frustrated. So that is always the first thing to attack, to make sure that all of the ways that increase the revenue are covered and always tested. The next approach is to have your test suite grow with a feature set. So every time a new feature is added, we write a new test for it. And next, I like to add a test for every new bug discovered to make sure that that bug does not recur when somebody accidentally reverts some code from last week or does a bad merge. So having a test for every bug you find and then making sure that the fix is still there Between these three, that will cover majority of your free time, unless you are in a situation where you have a lot of testers on your team and you can just spend time writing any other test you want. If you can cover those three approaches, the money path, the new features, and the bugs, your regression suite will slowly grow and grow and increase in size and usefulness. If you have resources to write tests for something in the past, hey, good for you, but maybe improving the existing test suite and making sure that your tests are more stable and more reliable and don't give you any false negatives or false positives is a much better investment than trying to write regression tests for code that has not been changed in a while.
Awesome. Yeah, I definitely agree. Follow the money. If there's a bug and there's not a test to cover that, create it. And if there's a new feature, if you follow those three, I think your test suite would be in good shape. I guess what happens now, though, is you have a ton of tests. Do you have any tips on how to manage your test environment? Because sometimes I get bogged down in setting up VMs, and it's almost like rather than testing, I get stuck doing the admin part of it. So do you have any tips around that?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I always felt that software testers are very perfect people to be in the DevOps field, because we care a lot about the test environment and we care about stability of the test environment, whereas the developers, they only want to write the code and send it out. Sysadmins, they only care about production. So test environments in general, they tend to be a little bit neglected by every side. So naturally, whether you are a manual tester or an automated tester, managing the test environment becomes a very high priority. That's part of the reason I went and learned all the sysadmin skills I could find just to keep my staging instance up and running so that my team can keep testing and not have to run out every time the database needs to be rebuilt or new code needs to be deployed. So there are multiple ways to test with automation, and it really, really depends on what environment you're trying to test on. And based on that, the amount of control over that environment will come into hand. If you are trying to test against production, for example, you have the least amount of control over the environment and over the data in that environment compared to testing it on your laptop. My favorite approach is to have the tests run on a node in continuous integration cluster that is dedicated to basically when a developer pushes a change to your version control, a node in Jenkins picks up that job and deploys the website locally, and it sets up the database to have local test data, and then run your first suite against that. And once that is passed, we can deploy the new build to step up to the next environment, whether it is integration environment or staging environment, and then have another run, hopefully with the same set of tests against that environment. And that way, by running it first locally, you increase a lot of unpredictable things that happen in staging environments, such as third-party dependencies, integration with Facebook or Twitter, all these other things. We can cut those out and just run the test against the new build of our application. When we're moving on to integration environment or staging environment, then we end up testing how the application works with all the other people and toys that are in our toolbox, I guess. So my approach is always start locally in continuous integration and then deploy to higher end server. And managing the test data, which is the next painful product, becomes more complicated when you're going from a local environment to a staging, because with a local environment, you can always tweak the data very quickly. Hey, these fixtures will have this user, so I know which user to log in with. So let's talk real quick about testing locally on one of the Jenkins nodes. Using VMware is one of my favorite things to do. At Groupon, we're using Docker right now. And what that allows us to do is for every test, we can spin up an environment, a test environment on the fly, test against it, and then destroy that virtual machine and replace it with a brand new one within seconds. This way, every single time our test runs, we do not have problems with the database. We don't have any problems with any test pollution or anything like that. If you're using VMware, such as VMware Fusion or the vSphere Center, you can do something similar where you have a base image and spin up a test environment in there to have your tests have a pristine condition every single time.
That was my next question, data management, because we have all these environments. We have a local environment. We have a staging environment. We have a, where I work, we have a ton of different environments. And one of the hardest things is the data management piece. So where I'm doing a code review, I'll look at some of their code and they're looking for an element with it, like with an ID that's only specific for that environment. So if it was to run in production, it wouldn't work. How do you combat that?
Well, the easiest way is, of course, to do it locally where you have the access to the backend database and you know what to compare your tests against. Yep. But working with higher environments in the food chain that are closer and closer to production, things do get much more difficult. Previously, I was in one project where it was a Java project, and the test environment, the integration environment, we did not have access to it. We had no ability to deploy to it. It was all done by the sysadmin group, but they did give us access to the JMX portal for that environment. That way we could, before the test would start, we could go and create all of the usernames and all the products that need to be added to the purchase flow. So having some sort of external setup condition before the tests run can be one of the most useful things you can do. And as always, the closer you get to production, the less write access you have to these environments. Then you start to rely more and more on ability to read what's going on in a database. And so one of the approaches you could take is if your website has a RESTful API to expose us to the public, for example, you have a website and you have an iPhone application. The iPhone application will go and talk to the API and ask for a list of available products. Well, you can harness that same API and have your test, before the tests start to begin, go through and interrogate the API and ask for what products exist on this website, if the user that you expect to be there exists, and just collect that for the test and then hand them off to the test either in an XML file or some other way that the test says, okay, this is the state of the environment right now, and so we should be able to pull up this product. So let's go pull it up and test with it.
I think that's a great tip. If you have RESTful APIs or a web service that's exposed to you in your application, you should make use of it. And if it makes your job easier, there's no reason why you can't use the functionality of your application to interrogate for data before you run your test. I think that's a great, great tip.
One other possibility is that if you have ability to deploy the data in the database every time you deploy to a different environment, and have a subset of a data that you just want to with expected users and whatnot. This way you deploy new build to staging and then you flush out the database and rebuild it from a known state and then test against the known state of the database. That will solve the data issues. Hopefully you are not in a situation where you're not allowed to do that as a tester, as a quality assurance individual, you're not allowed to have access to a staging database. And if you can't control that, that's a very, very tough position to be in.
Is there one thing you see over and over again in your experience that most people starting to create Selenium scripts or frameworks are doing wrong?
Absolutely. The first one is the most common problem that I see is the desire to have quantity over quality of the tests. You don't necessarily need to have a test that uploads your avatar image in your profile before you have a test that tests the registration of a user. And so going for 20 tests that do trivial things is less useful than having one test that attacks the money path and makes sure that there's no problems with your money path of the application. That is the biggest one. The next one is trying to solve some instabilities by adding weights and sleeps and thread that sleeps to make sure that, hey, the website is running a little bit slow on staging. So let's just have the test sleep for 10 seconds and then maybe it will be fine. Instead of trying to do something more intelligent and say, wait for the page to fully load, wait for all the AJAX requests to finish and then go on with the next step. That is the second most common thing. And the third one is this is what I'm very guilty of is early on, I would want to just get things done. Yeah, let's write the test. Let's do it. Let's go. And never really stepping back and looking at what am I trying to accomplish? Am I trying to build a framework that is stable, or am I just trying to write 10 tests so I can say that my test suite is now 20 tests long? Having some sort of background and understanding of how the applications grow and how to make them grow in a manageable way is a huge, huge improvement over just starting out and writing a bunch of tests.
Great advice. So your book also covers testing the behavior of an application using tools like Cucumber, using behavior-driven development. So do you find the overhead of behavior-driven development, do you find it as overhead or do you find it useful? When do you think it's appropriate to use BDD?
Some of the BDD tools such as Cucumber do have a very large overhead. Compared to them, something smaller and simpler like RSpec has a much lower overhead. So it really depends on what are you trying to accomplish. If I've noticed that RSpec, for example, has a behavior-driven syntax, but it is closer to what developers are used to seeing. It's written as code and not as natural language compared to Cucumber, which is much more natural language, but has a higher overhead in the backend because all the language needs to be parsed and needs to be correlated to actual actions on that the test needs to perform. So depending on what you're trying to accomplish, sometimes Cucumber is a great tool. Sometimes RSpec is a great tool. Sometimes no behavior-driven tool is a good option. And let's take a look at a couple of examples. If I'm writing a very, very small application that will only need 20, 30 tests and that need to run just really quickly, there's no reason to use a behavior-driven tool whatsoever because you're going to spend so much time setting up the framework in the first place just to write 20 tests for a little plugin application that will be written once and probably will not be updated for the next couple of years. Versus if you're trying to write a large shopping cart or airline booking system, a BDD tool can help you put things into a framework. However, having a behavior-driven tool can help you write a framework for a much larger application because it forces you to think about the application in smaller pieces, not necessarily as a set of actions. So Cucumber might be a very, very great tool if your team is non-developers who can look at the natural language and understand what the test is trying to accomplish right away. If your team is going to be development heavy, some other tools such as RSpec might be a lot more useful for you because it's more programming style instead of natural language style with all the natural language pitfalls that might happen. Which approach really depends on what the end goal is.
This is probably a whole nother episode, though. I wanted to get into your excellent video on scaling and managing Selenium Grid. Could you give us a quick blurb or a quick shout out about what your Selenium Grid extra open source package is all about?
Yes. So to those who are unfamiliar with Selenium Grid, the project tries to spread out the execution of the test onto multiple machines. That way you can have a test that can be running in Mac, Safari, at the same time Internet Explorer, but just run it in from a single place, but on multiple machines. So the idea is to kind of spread out the load. And what I found myself and many people who start to use Selenium Grid is that there are certain irregularities, especially when using Internet Explorer, older Internet Explorer, especially Internet Explorer 7 and 8, that make testing with the grid very difficult. Sometimes the browser will crash. Sometimes it will take down the system. Sometimes something unexpected will happen, or some feature such as multi-tier browsing where you have a page with mixed content such as HTTP and HTTPS on a single page. Sometimes those things are just disabled and they will make your test fail without giving you good explanation as to why your test is failing. At one point, I was writing a little scripts to mitigate that. If Internet Explorer crashes and there's a pop-up that says Internet Explorer crashed, well, if you don't close that pop-up, the next test that run will act unpredictably because that pop-up does influence the page. So I started off writing some scripts to close any of these pop-ups if they happen, and after each test to make sure and close the Internet Explorer browser, because if you don't close it, they will start to stack up and eat up all of your machine's memory, making the 20th test down the road crash with unbelievable and unexpected results. But I've noticed that all I had is 20 or 30 of these scripts in AutoIt, but they were difficult to maintain, and they did not really solve a lot of the new problems that I kept on running into. So I got permission from my boss to start a new project that would combine a lot of those little scripts that improve stability into a single management tool called Selenium Grid Extras. The idea there was to start developing the features that improve stability, and features such as recording of video as the test is running and saving that video, and then hopefully eventually try to merge those features back into the Selenium grid itself. That hasn't happened yet, but that's down the road the goal of the project. But the overall idea behind it is to kind of take away some of the complexities that come with managing the grid. But by default, all you have to do is just run Java jar Selenium Grid Extras. If that's the first time you run the application, it will ask you a bunch of questions such as, is this a grid hub or a grid node? Do you have Internet Explorer here or do you have Safari here? Things like that. And it would collect some of the data from you. And based on that, would configure the grid nodes with the appropriate timeouts and appropriate maximum instance numbers, etc., for that given browser. That way, a lot of that experience and trying to figure out instability is documented in code and not on a blog. So it's something that is actively trying to help you instead of trying to jump around everywhere and debugging a weird issue that you cannot understand.
Awesome. So I'll have a link to this video, Scaling and Managing Selenium Grid, which goes into detail about this approach and how the Selenium Grid Extras can help. And I'll also have a link to the book at www.testtalks.com/30. So Dima, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their Selenium automation efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
Best advice I can give is to slow down and never stop learning what is a good development practice. As you improve your development skills, you will improve your test writing skills, because those two are related. And treating the test as code and not as a set of instructions that are quickly slapped together by far is the best way to improve your test stability and just improve overall healthiness of your test suite. So as I mentioned before, there are several good design pattern books out there. It does seem like a waste of time to learn about design patterns and learn about how to best approach solving problems and as a programmer, because we just want to say, hey, we're not developers, we're just quality assurance people. We're just testers. We're not developers. So why do I have to learn any of that? And that feels to me that we, as a group, as software testers, we tend to sell ourselves short in that way. There's no reason we cannot be as good at writing code as developers are. There's no reason for us to kind of take the back seat and think that it's okay to write poorly written code that tests the website and then get confused and sad when the poorly written tests are failing and we are having a hard time managing them. Instead, we should just, in general, just always keep trying to improve yourself, always keep trying to get better at what you do. And when you do that, all of a sudden, your tests will become better, your programming skills will become better, and you will just honestly start to enjoy writing tests a lot more. It's nothing is more soul-crushing than having a test suite that is all over the place and just fails randomly. But when you build a test suite that is actually logical and well-written and any developer can look at and be impressed by. It actually makes you feel good about yourself and about the job you're doing. And I think that's by far just striving for that perfection is what will make you a happier software tester in general. The best way to reach me, as always, is through Twitter. My handle is Demicus. Always can ping me there, tend to reach out and answer. Similarly, the best, just good place to come out and ask questions about Selenium, and especially if you have a very difficult technical issue to solve, is IRC. The link to the IRC chat room can be found on the seleniumhq.org. It's right there at the bottom, and you will find a lot of the good developers who use Selenium there all the time. You will find Jim Evans, you will find Simon, and all the guys who actually wrote Selenium there. And they are really, really great people. And anytime you have a technical question that is difficult to solve and you've wasted already 5 days on it and you're about to throw your computer out the window, that's a good place to go and ask that question, because majority of the time the answer will be given really, really fast to you.
Awesome. Now, I'm an introvert, so I tend to shy away from things like that, but I logged in for the first time today after talking with Jim Evans, and I agree. It seems like it's going to be a great resource to go to.
As an introvert myself, I completely agree. the first time I logged into that channel, I was afraid to say or ask anything, but just watching, even if you're not going to ask a question, just keep an eye on it, and sometimes somebody else will ask a stupid question that you will learn something good from. So, hey, why not?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great, great, great tip. Thank you, Dima, for a great episode. And thanks for sharing your automation awesomeness. Cheers.
Cheers.
That's it for another episode of Test Talks. Head on over to testtalks.com and make sure to check out our exclusive sponsor, Sauce Labs, and their awesome special offer for Test Talks listeners only. So, as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.